Hello, you are listening to the Fight Night Picks Recap Show. I'm John Franklin. This week on the show, we discuss all the fights from UFC Fight Night, Hermanson versus Vettori recap, the recap show or from that card. I will do all this with one half, some would argue the better half of the Fight Night Picks preview show. I'm speaking, of course, to the great Matt Allen. Matt, I've done thousands, if not tens of thousands, of these podcasts with your brother Craig, and this is our first. How you feeling? Tell me your level of excitement for the show.
I am so excited. You have no idea. Doing a new show, this is great. First time we ever really get the chance to talk, so no, I could be more excited. A great card, too, to kind of recap. Not that many fights, but overall, quite a bit of exciting ones going on.
It was a fun night, so we got to get a few things out in the open to begin with, because, you know, this is kind of like a first date in a way. I'm not a prelim guy, Matt, so I'm gonna lean on you. There are some prelims I get deep into, but you'll know them when you see them for sure. So
that's
I'll
no
lean
issue.
On you. Go ahead.
That's no issue at all. No, goodness. I'm early riser, late sleeper, so no, I got you.
And I used to do this a while ago with a guy who, you know, wasn't so nice, but I'm sure that you have the Canadian thing going for you. You're much nicer, so I'm sure everything will be fantastic. All right, Matt. Let's talk about this card. We know what it was, but let's speak briefly about what it could have been. So we lost the Darren Till, Jack Hermanson bout. We lost Mirab Dvalishvili on this card. We lost Jack Hermanson and Kevin Holland. We lost quite a bit. So tell me your level of excitement for the card when you initially heard about it and how that morphed as some of these fights were sort of falling out.
So originally, I was so excited for the Darren Till matchup. I thought it was really interesting, too, because you had Till coming off that loss to Whitaker. It was a close fight. And having a close fight against Robert Whitaker really tells me something about you. And the fact that he was going to go right back in there against a guy like Jack Hermanson and kind of stay in the top of the division, I was really excited for it. And it's going to sound like I'm too much of a company man when it comes to this, but when Darren Till's at the top of the division, it's always a good thing for the UFC. Like, when there's a Darren Till fight, there is that extra hype behind it. You know, he's going to sell it a little bit better than just your average guy. So I was really excited for that fight. And the contrast of styles, too, between Hermanson and Till. Hermanson, of course, being such a good grappler. Didn't see a lot of that last night. And then Darren Till with the great striking. But the fight that I was the most upset about getting canceled, Hany Barcelos, Mirab Dvalishvili, that was going to be, it's not the best you can get at bantamweight, but that was really one of those kind of gatekeeper-ish matchups where you see, okay, if Mirab can beat a guy like Barcelos, he deserves to be at the top level. I know a lot of people aren't as hot on Barcelos as, you know, maybe some of the more hardcore fans like we are, but he's a guy who can beat anyone at 135 on any day, and that was going to be his first kind of big matchup in the top 15, so that was the one that I was really upset about. But all in all, I was still happy with the card that we got. It was kind of funny, as Craig and I were doing the kind of preview show right before the card, that's when those three fights had actually got canceled. The Evalev, the Nate Landwehr, Kevin Hall, I guess that was earlier on in the week, but the Talia Santos and the Jimmy Flick, so it was weird. We were getting so excited for the card, and then all of a sudden, it just kind of, oh, and there goes half your fight for the night. It was really weird night of fights.
It was, and you know, it's rare that you sort of stumble into such a good matchup, first off, which is Vettori and Hermanson, but then the fight it ended up being, you know, typically I try to get in the head a little bit of like Sean Shelby, used to be Joe Silva, to see like what the theme is. So I'm going to give you a rough theme. We'll see how much of this happened throughout the night, but it's a little bit of, you know, with everything that's swirling around the UFC right now with cuts, Yoel Romero leaving, it's a little bit of, you know, the vet and the young prospect and who's going to keep their roster spot potentially. So we'll get into that, but let's start with the main event. All right, Matt, initially it was thought the winner of this fight could put himself at or maybe two, you know, either one or two fights away from a title shot, but with Israel Adesanya booked a weight class up. And Dana as hitting at cuts, like we just spoke about, which we know will probably be high-priced veterans. This fight had a little extra juice, and boy, did deliver. The scorecards read 49-46, 49-46, 49-45, all in Marvin Vettori's favor, but it seemed a lot closer than that. Hermanson, who seemed to be almost out there, almost out of there early, was completely recovered and completely in the fight late. However, it always seemed like they were fighting Marvin Vettori's fight. That's what I saw. What'd you see?
I agree with a lot of that assessment. I really do. I thought it was weird going into the fifth round. I know they had brought up a stat right at the end of the fourth round that it said that Marvin Vittori's striking percentage was only around like 29%. He wasn't really landing a lot. He was like Chris Boucher from the three-point line. He does it with confidence, but he probably has no business taking those shots in the first place. With Jack, though, it was kind of odd. He has this weird kind of, I hate to say it, but he just looks uncomfortable on his feet when he is forced to strike for long periods of time. We saw that sort of, we saw the beginnings of it, I guess, in the Jared Cannonier fight when he wasn't able to get the takedown. You can tell he's got that weird, like, Ben Rothwell and heavyweight movement where he's just kind of all shifty and whatnot. Phenomenal fight, though. And I do think this says more about the improvements of Marvin Vittori than anything about Jack Hermanson. We knew what we were going to get from Jack Hermanson. He's going to go for the takedown. He's going to throw a high volume. You know what you're going to get. But for Marvin Vittori to show that he isn't the fighter that he was who lost the split decision to Israel Adesanya all those years ago, he's made the improvements. And I do think Rafael Cordero is a big reason for that. And it is kind of interesting trying to put our shoes in the matchmakers, because for Marvin Vittori, everyone at the top of the middleweight division seems to be coming off a loss right now. You have Paulo Costa, recently lost Adesanya. You've got Cannonier, who lost to Whitaker. And other than Robert Whitaker, I don't really know who you'd match Vittori up with. And Whitaker, to me, he's in the Francis Ngannou position where it's like, okay, you deserve a title shot. We're just going to have to kind of wait and see when we can put that together. So I don't really know what they do with Vittori from now. He's a young guy. He speaks really well. He seems to have a really good fan base behind him. He's currently the face of his country's MMA scene. So I don't really know what they're going to do moving forward with poor Vittori.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that I found interesting with this, and I'm going to make a crazy comparison here, but I'm going to tell you what I liked from Vittori last night. I'm going to compare Marvin Vittori to Conor McGregor, and here's why. Well, here's why. Because a lot of times with Conor, I've seen when people break him down that are much smarter than I am, they break him down by saying he's got a missile for a left hand, and he spends most of the fight making you forget about it until he can hit you with it. And what I saw from Vittori last night was a little bit Conor McGregor and a little bit Chuck Liddell, where he was using the right hook to sort of walk Hermanson into the straight left. And I think if that's what he was doing, and I could be wrong, but if that's what he was doing, I like that progression. I like the idea of knowing that I have this weapon that I like, that's highly effective, but the rest of my toolbox is to sort of camouflage that weapon so that, and he hit that left hand a lot. So here's a couple of questions that came out of the fight and some things that I saw in the fight. Do you feel like Hermanson ever really had him uncomfortable? I felt like it was Vittori's fight throughout.
I agree 100%. So I really like one thing too from Marvin Vittori, and I really like the point that you had made about him sort of forcing the right hook to kind of chase Hermanson into his left straight. Very Johnny Hendricks-ish too.
Yeah.
Johnny Hendricks back when he was knocking people out. That's what he did. He'd throw that right out there, get you thinking, and then smack you with the left, of course. But For Hermanson, no, he didn't. He wasn't able to get his takedowns going. And in every single grappling exchange they had, Vittori was the guy on top. Now, Kelvin Gastelum, for instance, he was on top of Jack Hermanson for all of about 10 seconds before he got heel hooked. And I think there was that one kind of moment in there where Hermanson at the end of the fourth was like, okay, I might as well hook for a heel at this point. It's kind of the end of the round. We'll see what happens. But they did fight not only at Vittori's, they didn't fight a Vittori fight. They fought at his pace the whole time, too. I really thought Jack Hermanson could outwork Vittori as the fight went on. And then, of course, it came out that Hermanson broke his foot. But the right high kick was landing for Hermanson. He had good weapons in the fight. It just seemed like he could never really get a lot of momentum behind any of it. So, no, I do agree. I do think, though, as the fight progressed, Marvin Vittori proved a lot about himself. Because when you see a fighter, they get off to a great start, then they kind of have that adrenaline dump, and Hermanson's working his way back into the fight. For a lot of young fighters, they can never get that momentum back. Once the fight's gone, they can never really get the reins. And I thought Marvin Vittori did a great example of that last night.
One thing that is a benefit for me being as old as I am and such an old head in MMA is I can sort of like, if not make direct comparisons with older fighters, I can sort of give you an idea of what comes with certain things. And the thing you think about Marvin Vittori was the first time I saw Vittori fight in a real way was the Adesanya fight where I was really paying attention. And, you know, it was a close fight. You could have, you know, it's going to be argued forever what happened in that fight. But I remember after the fight, sort of looking at Vittori and saying, hey, man, you were lucky to get this shot with this up-and-coming guy. Who does he think he is? It's kind of my takeaway, right? And it's funny that it's kind of like whatever Marvin Vittori thought he was and whatever the UFC thought he was, he's sort of been building himself into that, and now he's that. Like, now I believe him when he's in a post-fight interview where he says, hey, man, I should be fighting for belts or give me Adesanya or whatever, whoever he's calling out. He could have called anybody out last night. I'm like, yeah, sure, let's do it. part of the reason for that, and it was something I was going to mention later, but we can mention it now. It's, you know, these guys combined for the most significant strikes in middleweight history. Now, Robert, a lot of guys fight. Now, middleweight's been kind of a joke for a while when Anderson Silva was running the roost. It wasn't like there was a lot of guys that would be high-volume guys back then. So it's a little bit of a dubious distinction to have of being the guy. But, I mean, you know, the Whitaker-Yoel Romero fight was a fight where there was a lot of leather thrown. So that all that brings me to this. My two questions leaving this fight are, do you think Vettori is a championship-caliber fighter? Or if not, how close is he? And how much do you think Jack Hermanson loses in his, you know, standing in the middleweight division in defeat here?
So it's a really interesting point. I'm actually going to start with Hermanson. Hermanson reminds me a lot of Ricardo Lamas, kind of near the end of his run in the top five, because once Ricardo Lamas did start to lose it, you could kind of tell right away, you know, the speed all of a sudden wasn't really there, didn't kind of have the same pop on his shot. And for the longest time, too, Lamas only had one big win in the top five, and that was Cub Swanson that he had beat all the way back at WEC. But he had kind of just been going off that win for a while. And yes, he beat the Diego Sanchez of the world, and he had some nice wins in there, but he never really beat the elite of the elite. He just had so many wins that he stayed in the top five. Jack Hermanson, when you really do a deep dive on his record, the Jacare win's nice, but that's by far his best win. And I do think you have to ask yourself at a certain point, did he beat Jacare in that five-round main event because he was so good? Or was Jacare, is age starting to catch up with him? And that's something I'm really having a hard time with, because I do think Hermanson is a good fighter, and I do think he will be able to beat guys in the top 15. I just kind of worry about him against those upper echelon top guys in the top 10, because from what we've seen of his striking, I hate to compare him to Randa Markos, because it seems like we mentioned her on our channel more than anyone nowadays, but he does have that weird kind of wonkiness to his striking. And when I do see him up against the other guys at middleweight, like let's say Jack Hermanson fights Uriah Hall. Could he beat Uriah Hall? Of course he could. But that fight is one of those perfect, Jack Hermanson's going to win for about 14 and a half minutes. And then since the striking defense isn't very good, he's going to get clipped by a big bomb. So it does really worry me for Hermanson going forward. I know how good his grappling is. I know his striking's good in volume, but I do worry about his striking defense. If a guy like Marvin Vettori can put you down and hurt you at multiple points, I do worry about you fighting, you know, the Robert Whittakers, the Paulo Costas, the Jared Cannoneers. Of course, he lost to him already. So for Hermanson, just his style, I don't really know where to put it in the top 15. I'd love to get your opinion on that too. And for Vettori, I think he's close. The only issue is he has to beat either Israel Adesanya or Robert Whittaker to get to that title shot. And I don't know if anyone other than those two guys can beat each other right now at middleweight.
Yeah, I'm with you on your assessment of France. That's pretty legitimate. Did you get fully fleshed out with Vettori as his championship caliber? What do you think there?
Yeah, I do think it's possible. I think he's at the right gym. I think he's got the right coach for all of it. Again, it's just you look at who he has to beat to get to that title. And let's say if you gave Jack Hermanson, if it was his skill set on a heavyweight, yeah, he'd probably be the champ. Just because, you know, when you go up divisions, they start to get less skilled. It's just right now, he has to beat either Paulo Costa, which honestly, stylistically, he matches up quite well with, Robert Whittaker, who he doesn't match up well with at all, or Israel Adesanya, who is arguably the best striker, if not fighter, in the world right now. So it's just those two. Do I think he can get to the level? I do think so. I just think that there's a couple guys on that level right now in the division, and that's what might be hard for him to get past the hurdle.
Yeah, I think the good news for him is that, like I said, and I'll give credit where credit is due, Chael Sonnen said this on his channel, which is that once you – if you go up a weight class and get a belt, it's very rare that you come back down. And so the fortunate situation for Vettori would be Israel goes up, beats Jan Blachowicz. If it's a great fight, maybe they run it back. So now all this time sticking away, they strip the belt from Adesanya at 85, and now it's wide open. So he finds himself in a championship fight without having to beat the guy to get to Israel. You know, so him against Whittaker now becomes a championship fight as opposed to a number one contender fight. So that's, I think, you know, I just think that when these guys are going after belts, you got to check a lot of boxes, and Vettori's starting to check them for me. You know, does he look good in a main event? Does he go five rounds? You know, does he beat a guy who other people have looked poorly against? He's starting to do all these things. I'm starting to come around to the idea of him being a championship caliber fighter. I'm not all the way there yet. So you touched on it earlier. If I had to really to pin you down on two next fights for these guys, who do you have for each of them?
So again, I like the Uriah Hall fight for Hermanson, honestly. I know he's going to drop a little bit in the rankings. Hall's coming off a couple of wins, but to me, it makes a little bit of sense just because stylistically they are so different. And Hall does need a few more big wins. I don't think him beating Anderson Silva and kind of the way he beat Anderson Silva, he didn't get that much hype off of that fight. Like if he had gone out there and knocked out Silva like he did Gegard Mousasi, I do feel like we'd be talking about Uriah Hall quite a bit more right now. But the fact that he just knocked out a 43-year-old or 45, however old he is, too old to be fighting in the UFC, but however old he is, I do think Uriah Hall still needs one of those, a win against a real live contender. I know he's beaten Shoeface. I know he's beaten, I guess, Mousasi in the past. He's had good fights with some of the guys at the top of the division, but I really do like that matchup. And for Vettori, it does seem like everything's going towards that Whittaker fight, but I think it's too soon. I'd love to see him get one more in him. Again, it's too bad that Yoel got cut because that could have been a really fun fight, and then you let Yoel go, and then maybe we get the Whittaker-Vettori matchup. But yeah, other than Vettori and Hall, I can't really think of anyone else for these guys.
It's tricky because, you know, that is the perfect fight for Vettori. But, you know, it's like if you're Dana White, you cut another six-figure check just to get Vettori another guy on his resume. Probably not. So they had to, you know, part ways when they did. All right, let's move on to the co-main event. Matt, on Ovince St. Preux's best nights, he's knocking out Shogun Hu and Corey Anderson and going the distance with John Jones. On his worst nights, he's getting choked out by Nikita Krylov or Ilir Latifi. On this evening, he drew DWCS alum Jamal Hill, who's surging. In short, this was Dana White's nightmare, an inconsistent veteran fighter versus his wet dream, a DWCS vet who looks ready for prime time. Let's start our analysis with something I saw on Twitter and build a conversation from there. Someone said that OSP looked like he didn't want to be there. Is that how you read his body language? And then tell me what you saw in the fight.
Have you ever seen an OSP fight where he looks like he wants to be there? Like, that's the real question. I've never seen a more tired guy enter the cage. Like, him and Mousasi are tied 1A and 1B for the Who Just Got Out of Bed award of the night. Because OSP, this is something, and I did text Craig this right before the fight. I can bring up the receipts. When they were showing both guys warming up, OSP was sitting down and looked dry. And Jamal Hill was throwing long combinations. He had a really good sweat build up. And I told Craig, I said, watch out. OSP might get knocked out early because he's cold going into the fight. Now, it didn't happen exactly how I called it. Hill did have quite a bit of trouble kind of getting in on the range of OSP. But that always worries me. It's something they talk about a lot more in boxing than they do in MMA. But there's something to be said for eating a shot cold as opposed to eating a shot once you're already warmed up. Like Jamal Hill was full-blown sweating. Like he had looked like he'd been warming up for like half an hour before his fight. He was ready. Whereas OSP, everyone in the commentary kept on saying, oh, he's uber confident coming into this fight, although he had missed weight the day before. And they just kept on talking to, and again, I think you'll appreciate this, Craig and I have this thing where the earlier your personality gets brought up in your draft analysis, the worse player you're going to be. And the fact that they kept on bringing up how confident OSP was, that was something that worried me going into this fight. Now, I think the UFC must be thrilled that he lost. And this sucks, and I hate to say it because I'm a big Ovince St. Preux fan. I can see him being one of those 60 to 80 names being cut by the UFC. It's unfortunate. I love watching him fight because something crazy is always going to happen, whether he wins or loses. But he's one of those guys with a bigger contract. And like you had mentioned, he's been there. He's kind of done that already. He does have a win over current Bellator light heavyweight contender, Corey Anderson. So maybe there's a little hype there, but it's unfortunate for OSP. I hope that if they don't cut him, he can kind of get some of the motivation, if you will, back that we did see on his earlier runs, because there was a time when OSP was just starching people. And the Jimmy Manuel fight was a bad one. He's had a few bad performances, but like you said, on his best day, he can beat anyone. I don't know if we're ever going to see those best days from OSP. I don't like it when a guy moves up to heavyweight and then moves back down to 205. I always think that's a big concern because Conor McGregor, for instance, moves up to 70, moves down to 55. Not that big of a deal because he must know, okay, I can get up to a certain weight. This is still my limit. I still have to make 170 no matter what. OSP weighed almost 240 pounds when he fought Ben Rothwell. And then he had to cut back down to 205. Now, I know he made it in his first fight back down, but that's a big weight fluctuation for you to be going through a lot. So I think that might have hurt him. I think the game's catching up to OSP too. I really do. The fact that he just throws a lot of looping shots and he's such a big counter guy. I do think once you reach a certain age, the counter striking doesn't work as well. Your reflexes aren't as fast. You're not going to be able to hit your opponent with a big shot. So I know I've gone on for a long time about OSP, but it is really unfortunate because he's a guy you always sort of cheer for, but he's just never really been able to get back on track to where he was when he fought John Jones for that interim belt.
Yeah, you know, so I agree with you. And the one thing I'll say about the Conor McGregor situation is different from OSP is that Conor McGregor calls his own shots. So Conor McGregor is going to go up in weight and come down in weight on his timetable. OSP is going to go up and wait and come down and wait in the UFC's timetable. They're going to say, hey, we know you just fought Ben Rothwell, but here's the fight. Take it or leave it, and you should probably take it. You know, here's the thing that I thought was interesting, and I agree with you that OSP doesn't always come in there super thrilled or super motivated looking for fights. Here's what I thought last night, and now, in fairness, what I'm about to tell you is me looking at OSP in a vacuum last night, so feel free to shred this if you think it has no legitimacy, but I felt like he was trying to give a young fighter a lot to process, and I felt like he was trying to – he sort of said, I can't match his energy level. I can't match his volume or his output, so I'm going to try and be efficient, pick my shots, give him a lot to process, switch stances, and see if just maybe I'm just going to flood this kid with so much information that because he's young, he's not going to know what to do, and I'll find the opening that I need. And to Jamahal Hill's, you know, credit, he just didn't let OSP find the hole. This is one thing with me in fights is that all fighters come into fights with holes. It's just a matter of who can find the other person's holes faster. Like, you know, you're susceptible to the body, or you're susceptible to being taken down. When can they figure out where I'm the weakest the fastest? And I think OSP was like, all right, let me just switch stances on this kid, try some different things. And so on the one hand, it's a criticism of OSP. But on the other hand, I think that, and we're going to talk about Benitez later, but I think it's a credit to Hill of, like, he took all that information and he took, you know, some shots from OSP. You know, there's things that guys like OSP like to do where, like, they'll throw a hook over your jab, or they'll find little openings in a young fighter's defense, and they'll try and make them count. And I don't think OSP was prepared to make them really count last night, but I think that Hill's pace and volume were just too much for him.
Go ahead. And I agree with that. No, 100%. I like what you said about OSP. It did seem that way, because I thought it was odd he spent so much time in the orthodox stance. I know Trevor Whitman had spoke about it on the broadcast a little bit, just about how defensively OSP wasn't as good there. But yeah, OSP, you have such a good left leg for kicking. I don't know why you would ever go orthodox. Like, you've done pretty much southpaw your whole entire career. I know he will switch stances on occasion, but OSP is a southpaw fighter for the most part. So it was really odd that he decided, okay, how about I go up against this young prospect and there's not a lot of film on him, and let's try something new all of a sudden. I do think it speaks to the fight IQ of OSP a little bit, but I think that's something we could talk about in all of his fights. How do most OSP fights go? He gets dominated in either grappling, or he gets outstruck, and then he can land something crazy, or you go for a guillotine, he gets into side control, and of course, you're asleep the next thing you know. So I do think this comes down to Jamahal Hill's just, like, he's a problem at 205, more than OSP's completely over the hill. Like, I think OSP can offer a lot of guys tough fights, because like you said, on his best day, we know what we're getting from him, but Jamahal Hill just might be the new breed.
He might be, and you know, there's this conversation that we're having, which is why I love this conversation, is it's kind of spawned an idea in my head, which, you know, we'll talk about in the DMs, but I'll give you a little, and the audience, a little bit of a preview, is that, you know, a lot of guys' resumes need to be looked at with context. And you do have to figure out if it's, you know, who's over the hill or who's coming on. And that's why these things take a while to play themselves out. So then let me ask you the question that brings up, which is, do you think Jamahal Hill's in the fast lane now in terms of 205, meaning, you know, has he officially jumped on a hype train? And if he has, if he is in the fast lane, should he be?
I'm going to bring up a weird comparison. When Bruce Roberts fought Brock Weaver and looked amazing, I was like, okay, good. There's another new prospect. Everything looks great. Then he fought Jim Miller, and I hated that matchup because Jim Miller loves to do two things. Ruin people's hype because he's an old man, has old man strength. And also, if you beat a guy like Jim Miller, there's no easy fights from then on out. And if you're a really good prospect, beating a guy like OSP, there's no easy fights from there on out. Like, you're only going to fight the Ion Chukalabas, the maybe Carl Roberson if he decides to go back up to 205. Like, you're only going to be fighting some of those top tier guys from now on. Your name is now probably going to have a ranking next to it. So is Jamahal Hill good enough to beat the Nikita Krylovs of the world, the Johnny Walkers of the world? I do believe so. I just think it's weird that you have a guy who is so inexperienced in his career who is going to have to be fighting some of these bigger dogs at some point. Because 205, I think we both agree, one of the more shallow divisions right now in the UFC. So maybe he can get some key wins pretty quick and work his way up the division quite fast. But I do think he's in the fast lane. I think beating a guy like OSP, especially by finish in the impressive way that he did, warrants a higher standard, I guess, of competition from there on out.
Well, here's where it gets tricky. I mean, let's talk about the elephant in the room. If you're a skinny, 6'4" black guy, 205 pounds, and you start taking people out, everybody starts thinking about John Jones. And I think that that's no favor to him, but it is what it is. I mean, they ran John Jones through that ringer, and he passed with flying colors. He took everybody out, grabbed a belt, and kept it forever. So I don't know that that's what we're looking at here in Hill. And that's a lot to lay on anybody. Is are you the next, you know, are you the next John Jones is like saying is somebody the next Michael Jordan. So yeah. It's tricky, though, when fighters fall out. We're in a pandemic. So these opportunities arise. And like you said, it's a huge opportunity for Hill to fight OSP. But does that necessarily mean his next fight should be against someone of OSP's caliber? Like, or should they bring him along easy? Like we said, not everybody's John Jones. I don't always trust what I'm looking at when I look at Tapology's rankings. But what it does is it gets me in the ballpark, right? So what they have is they got Hill at 19, and they had OSP at 17. So the first question for Hill is I would say it's too early to go into the top 10, right? We can agree on that?
I would agree.
So if you had a choice between Ryan Spann's booked, all right? So if you had a choice between Paul Craig, Jimmy Crute, and Johnny Walker, who would you give him?
I got to be honest, Jimmy Crute's the only guy out of those three who I think even has a remote chance against Hill. Like, Johnny Walker, we know the craziness. Here's the thing about Hill, too, that I do like, and that I do think you can take from the OSP fight, because it's that little step further than just Tapology. He had to overcome two things in that fight. He had to overcome the issue of, I'm not in range for a lot of that first round. He was missing a lot of his shots, especially when he was going in combination, but he found a way to overcome that. He found a way to get OSP up against the cage and kind of work around that issue. I really like that when you look at a prospect. And also, the leg kicks of OSP were starting to add up. Like, again, we can all talk about the knockout and how great that was. If OSP landed 5 or 6 more of those clean, like, that could have been a completely different fight. I really do think so, because they were starting to get the Hill. You could tell as the fight was going on, he was walking a little ginger on it. But yeah, other than Jimmy Crute, like, Jimmy Crute, okay, he could take down Hill. He could probably ground and pound him. That'd be his easiest path to victory. Johnny Walker's going to stand and do crazy things against a guy who has really solid fundamentals, so I doubt Johnny Walker beats him. And then Ryan Spann, if I know he's matched up, but I doubt he has much of a chance. That's the problem. With 205, you're either fighting guys who are beatable, we'll call them, or you're fighting the elite of the division. So it is really weird to kind of pinpoint where Jamal Hill belongs in all this.
Yeah, I think that if I'm the UFC now, what you do is you start to – I'm a big fan. And here's another, bygone podcast I was going to do that we haven't never got to. But this thing called the blueprint. I think every fighter has a blueprint to get them to the title, right? So if you're trying to figure out what Hill's blueprint is and you're the UFC, I think that you say, listen, is this guy talented enough to be a champion? Yes. Is he marketable enough to be a champion? Yes. Okay, then how do we build him a resume that not only gives him a bunch of names that we can sell to the public, but also gives him a bunch of skill sets that he has to overcome, right? So I think maybe a guy like Paul Craig makes sense just because he has to solve that puzzle, you know what I mean, of like some of the stuff that Paul Craig's able to do. So I'm not advocating for Craig. I'm just saying that his next opponent should be more a style than a name. If that makes sense. Like, if you're going to bide time with this guy anyway, and you're not ready to put him in the top 10, then find the right style. Don't put him in there with a guy who fights like a guy he just beat.
I'd rather see him fight Paul Craig than Craig Allen, so.
I'd rather see him lose to a guy who's a bad style matchup than have him beat a bunch of guys. Like, I'd rather see him, this is going to sound crazy, but I would rather see him lose to Paul Craig than beat Glover Teixeira. Because I know that he can stand with guys. And Glover Teixeira is a smart enough fighter to just outsmart him. So why, you know what I'm saying? Like, he can pull him into things, and he's a lot craftier of a striker. What Ovince St. Preux is trying to do to Hill, Glover Teixeira could do to Hill because he's just a smarter fighter. So that's what I think. Now you start matching him up with guys that are going to improve his fight IQ. I think that's what's next.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
All right, guys, let's move on. Matt, it's been a busy year for Justin James, who collected a bonus in June for taking out Frank Camacho in spectacular fashion. However, it was his opponent who cashed a bonus check last time out, as Gavin Tucker strangled him in the third round of their fight. On this night, he drew Gabriel Benitez on a two-fight skid after dropping a decision to Omar Morales in a first-round finish at the hands of Sadiq Youssef. However, on this night, it was Benitez with the hand raised, and he knocked the wind out of both James's sails and his body with a video game knee to the gut that shut James down. Man, I took a lot from this fight, and we'll get into it, despite it being as short as it was. I want to start with what you saw, and then we'll talk about what I saw.
I don't want to say I called this fight to a T or anything, but I'm going to give myself a little pat on the back on this one. Gabriel Benitez is just a bad matchup for Justin James, and James did do a few things really well. He was committed to the aggression, and yes, that was kind of a part of his downfall, but he was landing shots throughout the fight. I was a little concerned to see when and if James was going to use his wrestling in this one, but with Gabriel Benitez, I never felt like we saw the best version of him at 145. I know he had a lot of good performances. I know he beat some good fighters. The Jason Knight fight was the first one that really stood out to me, because with Jason Knight, you knew what you were going to get with him, at least at the time. He had got knocked out by Ricardo Lamas at UFC 214, and then they matched him up quick with Gabriel Benitez, because not that he was a big name at the time, but he was a guy that the UFC was trying to get a little shine to. Gabriel Benitez beat the brakes off that poor man. That fight wasn't competitive in the slightest. He landed combos, knees, kicks, beat him up really bad. And then from that point on, I've always been sort of one of those, I'm a closeted Gabriel Benitez fan, I'm not going to lie. And the fact that he went out there and basically kneed a guy in the spine, like, he went through everything to hit him. He sent a man flying across the cage with one knee. I was really impressed. And for Justin James, you kind of know what you are going to get in a lot of his fights. This fight did look very similar to the Camacho fight. It's just the difference was he landed the shots on Camacho, and Benitez was just able to counter. So I'm really excited for where Gabriel Benitez goes in the future. And with Justin James, it's weird to pinpoint him because, okay, you beat Frank Camacho, who, it's not that he's a name by any means, but I think he's a more recognizable guy than just, you know, welterweight or lightweight fighter A. He's a guy who's been in some crazy fights. He's had some fight of the night, so he's somewhat recognizable. The fact that James knocked him out in a minute, I was like, oh, damn, Justin James, like, he could be a real name in this division. And then the Gavin Tucker fight kind of played out like this one. The difference was, though, Tucker couldn't punish him on the feet as much as Benitez could, but he found a way to get the fight to the ground. Whereas Benitez, he figured, okay, if I wait for him to rush at me, he's going to land into something big, or he's going to walk into a big shot. He was landing the uppercut all night, and then he just figured out the knee was the weapon that he was going to use. So I really like what I saw from Benitez. I'm excited to see where he goes in the future. I know he's had a few bad losses, but when you look at the losses, like, okay, a lot of people are going to lose to Sadiq Youssef at 145. That's not an issue to anyone. And Omar Morales, I think he's a really good fighter. I know he didn't look great against Giga Chikadze in his last one, but I think that was a case of Benitez, that's his first fight in the weight division. Give him one fight and sort of settle in, and then we're off to the races. So I'm really excited for where Benitez is now at lightweight.
Yeah, and again, there's something about being 43 and watching as many fights as I've watched. You don't remember them as much as you would like to. So a lot of these fights, the cool thing about, I think, our dynamic is that I watch things in a vacuum and you watch them with context because you have to prepare yourself for the preview show. So when I looked at this kid, you know, I'll see somebody who's a world beater and then I look up their resume, I'm like, this dude lost two fights, his last two fights. Let's talk about techniques for a second. One, I like anybody that starts with kicks and ends with combos, which Benitez was doing. And I like anybody that starts with combos and ends with kicks. I don't think that's done enough. I think it's just another layer to add to a fight that you have your opponent has to deal with. These kicks to the back leg, let's talk about them for a second. Do you think there's something to that? Do you think that Benitez is, like, it's cool that he can do it, not a lot of guys do it? Or do you think that it's like he's opening up this other wave of things? Because, you know, these guys are – it's like anything else. You know, they say the NFL is a copycat league. Well, fighting's copycat. Somebody does something well. You see one guy punching a leg. Benson Henderson's throwing, you know, straight right hands to the leg, and then everybody's doing it. John Jones is doing teep kicks, and everybody's doing it. Yeah. Do you think that this is a technique that has this is a horrible pun. Do you think this technique has legs, or do you think it's just something Benitez does and it gives him an advantage over guys?
It is a weird question. I think that really comes down to the body type of the fighter. I just don't know how many fighters really have that kind of style and the build to be able to reach that leg all the way back. And a little bit of that was just the reaction of Justin James. I think he'd been kicked to that front leg so many times that when he thought the leg kick was coming, he just pulled back his front leg, and then that would leave the back one. It's the only thing planted, so Benitez is going to have to continue through to something. I do think it comes down to more how James was defending it. I think if Benitez can use that in future fights, it's phenomenal. They mentioned on the broadcast multiple times about how, listen, you're not used to being kicked in that back leg. Like, the front leg, you can condition it to a certain point. Joseph Baltellini, big fan of Bazooka Joe, he used to talk about how, like, in his kickboxing days, he would roll either glass Coke bottles or rolling pins on his shins and just hit it as over and over and over again as hard as he could. So just keep on like compounding the bone on top of itself, which is crazy to think of the dedication that requires. But anyways, I think we will see it from a few guys. If you're a guy like an Adesanya who does have that reach to get the leg all the way back, I think we'll see it a little bit more. The issue is you're leaving yourself really open if you're closing the distance all the way to your opponent and then trying to reach their back leg. Because you have to think, let's say he's fighting a guy like, I know it's a big step up in competition, but let's say he's fighting a guy like Dustin Poirier and you're going for that back leg constantly. We're just going to step straight and land a straight punch. He will find that out eventually. So I do think it's going to be one of those case by case. I think we'll see other fighters maybe experiment with it a little bit in the upcoming weeks, months. But it is hard to say, like, what is going to be the next groundbreaking technique in MMA. Like, I never thought 5 years ago that a calf kick would be just as good as an overhand, right? But look where we are in 2020.
Yeah, I do think, like you said, I mean, you know, I've talked on other recap shows and in the past about how, like, you know, when you're a fighter, you got to be either all the way in or all the way out. This puts you all the way in, but not in the way that you necessarily want to be. I mean, you're susceptible to a lot of things. Most guys drop their hands when they kick. I mean, there's a lot of problems it creates. I don't know that it now the one thing that makes it interesting is that, you know, I don't know how you would protect that. I mean, if the guy's kicking your back leg, what, do you switch stances? Well, now it's closer to him. You can just kick, you know. So it does bring up an interesting technique discussion. But again, I think there's only a handful of guys who can do it. And it can be easily adjusted to once you see it enough. So, yeah. All right, so let's move forward. Do you think that – I mean, Jane's put some leather on Benitez here. Do you think – that is it because Jaynes was Benitez's success because Jaynes was trying to be so offensive that he sacrificed his defense and that left a lot of openings for Benitez? Or what do you think? Because I mean, it wasn't like Jaynes wasn't moving forward. It wasn't like he wasn't being active. He was trying to, like, whenever he's, you know, some guys, you know, they'll bite down on the mouthpiece thing. Some guys get cracked a little bit and they're like, okay, I need to bring a lot of energy to this. I need to bring a lot of volume. Other guys go, okay, I need to sort of play some defense. And you know, I'm a big fan of defense can sometimes equal offense. If you frustrate a guy enough by taking away his offense, it opens up your offense a little bit. That's not what Justin Jaynes was doing. So do you think that Benitez looked as good as he did because Jaynes was not interested in playing any defense?
I do think it comes down to styles. You sort of knew, okay, if Justin Jaynes is going to win this fight, he's coming with big power, he's throwing those big looping shots around. But I do think as the fight was going on, he was landing shots, but you could tell that, okay, if he's going to land one of those big overhand rights, a lot of the time Benitez would kind of catch it on the arm or roll with it a little bit. He was definitely the more, I'll say, defensive-minded fighter, even though we didn't get a lot of defense out of either guy. But when Benitez was sort of figuring it out, you could tell, like, once he started landing that uppercut up the middle, about 2 minutes before the actual knockout happened, he started landing the uppercut, and you could tell, okay, Benitez now sees that that's an opening. Going right up the middle is a way to hit Jaynes. Because he was crashing in and then throwing around with power, like a knockoff Justin Gaethje. And then Benitez figured it out. Just as the fight was going on, he was making those small adjustments. And it played out a lot like the Sadiq Youssef fight. The only difference is, Sadiq Youssef is a real threat at 145, whereas Justin Jaynes, I don't want to be disrespectful, but he is just kind of a guy at 155.
Yeah, and Jaynes is a guy who, like, you know, Benitez fights with his brain and Jaynes fights with his nuts. I mean, you could tell. Exactly. He goes in there, he's looking to throw hands, and if he lands one, he gets a $50,000 check. If he doesn't, he probably gets an L. So, yeah, from that perspective, do you see anything long-term for either of these guys? I mean, do you see them on any type of – I know you're a Benitez fan, but I guess
– Exactly. So it's
when we're matching them. We're matching them up next. I mean, where do you level Benitez out? Top 25, top 20? Right now.
Benitez, right now, I've got a matchup. I was talking to Craig about this when we were driving into town. I kind of like Benitez and Bobby Green, oddly enough. I know it's a weird fight. Green was on, we'll call it a run before he lost to Moises, but I really like that fight. I think it'd be an interesting one. At the worst case scenario, it would be a fight of the night contender on the prelims. So I think that would be a really fun fight moving forward because I don't think Benitez is ready for the, you know, he's not ready for the Gregor Gillespies, if you will. Just trying to think of guys outside the immediate top 15. He's not there yet. He has shown promise. And I do think I'm going to cap Benitez at a one of those weird guys who, when you check the rankings, one day he might be number 15. They check the rankings the next day and they've like bumped him out for another guy. I think that's a ceiling. We may see him with like a 13 next to his name one day. He's in a very specific club, though. He's in the, damn it, I wish this guy was 4 years younger club. Because if he wasn't 32 right now, and if he was, you know, 26, 27 and had this skill set, I'd be really excited for his future at 155 with the losses that he's had, with sort of his skill set moving forward. Just the fact that he's not really a young gun, if you will, or a prospect. So I think he'd be in fun fights moving forward. I just kind of question the level of success he will have.
You know, he reminds me of a little bit. He reminds me of Beneil Dariush. Like, he does a lot of things in the cage that get you really excited, but you can never imagine him in the top five, really. Like, I can't imagine Dariush getting close, but I can never imagine, like, a poster with Beneil Dariush and, like, you know, and whomever he's fighting. Do you know what I mean? I can't imagine him fighting Justin Gaethje for the belt or Poirier.
That's true.
Like, Dariush and Conor McGregor on a poster. Although I love, you know, 50 things that Dariush does. That's, I guess,
I was gonna say, we stand Dariush pretty hard here.
There you go. All right, let's move on, Matt. We've moved on to the portion of the podcast where I get concerned about the pronunciation of a fighter's name. So if I butcher it, that's where you come in. Matt, Roman Dolidze is an undefeated fighter. He's well put together, fights out of Extreme Couture, and has a full tool belt of skills on the feet and on the floor. He has plenty of reasons to think highly of himself, and boy, does he ever. On his way to a split-decision victory over John Allen, no relation, he was smiling at his opponent, talking to his corner like he was Floyd Mayweather or some shit. I saw a pretty good fighter who wanted to end the fight a certain way and almost cost himself a victory. What did you see? I mean, he was never really in any danger here, but Allen, you know how those Allen boys are. Allen, he was game, and he looked like he could have put something together because Dolidze was just in there screwing around at times.
Exactly. This fight reminded me a lot of, going to throw it back a little bit, when John or when Brett Johns fought Pedro Munhoz. Pedro Munhoz was beating the brakes off poor Brett Johns the entire fight, but he really wanted to finish by guillotine. And for some reason, Pedro Munhoz loves the guillotine on the left side. And every time he'd hurt John, people forget, he put on a show in that fight. He dropped him with a leg kick, head kick, and body kick throughout that fight. He was having his way with the poor guy. But he just really wanted to finish by submission. John's really good grappler in his own right. So every time he'd hurt him, he'd jump on the neck, jump on the neck, jump on the neck. And it never really cost him. He wasn't in any danger in that fight. We could tell that that was just the way he wanted to win. And the whole time last night, I'm yelling at my TV, like, Roman, just commit to the ground and pound. You have him hurt. He can't do anything to it. Why are you going for the ankle constantly? He'd done it at the end of, I think it was the second round with like 10 seconds left. Stuff like that's fine, but unless you're Gary Tonin in an MMA fight, I don't think it's really worth rolling for the knee ever. And it was really weird. I think Dolidze has a lot of skills that you do look for in sort of a prospect. But again, he's a guy who I have to throw into that category. We're going to mention it a few times on this card. He's in the, I really wish this guy was younger boat. He doesn't have a lot of experience. He's only got a few fights on his record. But he is 32. And I know he said last night that he wants to move down to 185. Please give me all of that, because I think there's a lot of fun matchups down there for him. But it's just a weird age for a guy to be moving down in weight. I always like it when guys kind of figure out their weight class in their mid-20s. After you're sort of done growing, you figure it out. Okay, I was a featherweight. Now I'm a lightweight. My body's a lightweight. We're good. You don't have to be like a Jake Collier, who I'm sure we'll mention, who was like, hey, I'm a middleweight and I'm jacked. What if I just ate myself up to heavyweight? Now, very different, but it is always weird when a guy who is a little bit later on in their age, if you will, decides to move down in weight. It's never something that gets easier the older you get. It's always the opposite. That does concern me, but if he can make that weight, fine. There's a ton of fun fights down at 185 you can make for him.
Yeah, you know, listen, I can speak as an older guy, and I can tell you this. When you get older, it's the time to if you can get your diet right. I've always thought that, you know, instead of like missing weight and being the guy who's got a little bit of money in the bank, a nice house, and can just, you know, has the resources to always have a great meal, you know, the 205 turns into heavyweight. I think if you go to 85, then you can sort of like reform your lifestyle. Now, if you're not going to do that, you're just going to try and cut to it. That's bad news. All right, so here's my questions coming out of this fight. The big one, and this is unfair. I used to do a podcast with Hot Take Kate called Recency Bias. So I'm no stranger to being a prisoner of the moment, Matt. It's unfair to do this, but I'm going to compare Jamahal Hill and Roman Dolidze as prospects. So obviously one's much older than the other. Who's farther along in their progression? Who do you think has a higher ceiling? They're both undefeated. who do you like more and why? Like, if you were the UFC and you really wanted to put a push behind somebody, who would you choose?
Without question, Jamahal Hill. and it's nothing against Roman Dolice. I do really like where he's going in his career. He's an exciting guy. He puts on fun fights. And at the end of the day, that's all anyone cares about. One of the wildest predictions I've ever got right was right before Elias Theodoro fought Derek Brunson. Both guys were ranked, and it was just, hey, this is a co-main event fight. Elias, he always fought in that style that was like, okay, I don't care how many losses he has in a row. If he loses one fight in like a really boring way, I can see him getting cut. Lo and behold, he fights Derek Brunson, and you know, it sucks when a guy in the rankings does unfortunately get cut, but the UFC cares about excitement more than they care about anything else. Like, Justin Gaethje got a main event after losing two fights in a row by knockout against James Vick. He'd been knocked out by Alvarez. He'd been knocked out by Poirier. The UFC's like, well, he's still super exciting. We want him in five-round fights. We'll still put him up against James Vick in a main event. So I think Dolice, even if he does have a bit of a checkered record going forward, if he does get a few losses down at 185, he is forced to change a few things in his game. I don't think it's going to be the end of the world. I do think that his fighting style will at least keep him in the UFC. Whereas Jamahal Hill, let's say he does fight Jimmy Crute next, just for an opponent. Let's say Jimmy Crute submits him. And then he fights Paul Craig, I guess. And then he loses that fight too. Then you kind of worry about him just because when he's not winning, it's not like he's the most exciting guy. Like, he's got really good boxing. He's got really good fundamentals. For Dolice, too, I think the move down in weight really does matter. Like, if you had a Hall fighting Dolice right now at 205, I'm picking Jamahal Hill without question. That would be a fight night picks, like, lock of the week, which never turn out. But still, I just don't like where Roman's age is. I think he's an exciting guy. I think he's going to be around the UFC for a while because he can beat the top names. I'm just really worried about how much better can he get at the age of 32? Like, is this the finished product that we're seeing right now and it's just kind of figuring out where that guy's ceiling is? Or is there sort of a next gear that he can get into, like Pascal Siakam after he won the Most Improved?
Or Glover Teixeira, who it took a minute to come over to the UFC and then still had a, you know, you can make an argument. I mean, had he picked up a belt along the way, that you could put Glover Teixeira in the Hall of Fame based on what he's done just in the UFC, and it felt like it took forever for him to get here. So, you know, I think that if you're a guy like Dolice, you got to go into business for yourself at this point. The age that you're at, where you're at in the rankings, I think you need to start calling guys out. I think you need to start – I mean, he has enough of a personality that he needs to really start to put the gas on his career. And I think that, like you said, he can gain a lot of ground by doing that, and I think he's capable of doing it. Listen, the guy fights out of Extreme Couture, so I don't know if he's aware, but the UFC PI and the UFC offices are not that far away. So maybe he gets in the car every once in a while and swings over by the UFC PI to see what Dana's up to and get himself out there. He needs to have a presence somewhere else. He needs to have some sort of a gimmick, and I think that would help him out a lot. All right, Matt, let's talk about the first fight of the main card. I'm going to quote Dave Chappelle here in the old Chappelle Show. I don't know what to say about Matt Wyman that has been said about Afghanistan. His ass was bombed out and depleted. Hashtag boycott Chappelle Show. Matt, I have a lot of notes on this fight because there wasn't much action to talk about. So I'll give you the floor, and I'm just going to read all these notes I got and go.
I don't think I've ever seen someone go from smiling to knocked out faster in my whole entire life. I've never seen a weirder situation. Okay, so let's just recap the fight quick. It was only 22 seconds. Jordan Leavitt picks up Matt Wyman, kind of holds him there for a second. His coach goes, bring him over here. Fairly normal. You see that a lot. He's got him in a pretty good spot, so he can carry him over. Matt Wyman's like, great, we're going to the ground. That's where I'm really good. And then next thing you know, we get like a Pride-era rampage Ricardo Arona-esque slam. And I do like sort of the mindset afterwards, because in the moment, you just see the slam, one guy's unconscious, and you're like, wow, you know, what really happened? I like that Jordan Leavitt sort of explained it in his post-fight interview. He was like, no, we practiced all the time. Like, I framed off on his head, so his head couldn't really recoil once I hit him. So it's just going to be his head hitting the mat. Like, he sort of knew what he was going to do as he was going in there, where with most slam KOs, it's okay. I'm defending a submission. This is the best way to get out of it. I really liked what we saw from him in the short amount of time. But again, this is my issue, and I go back to this a lot. If you're Jordan Leavitt, I didn't really learn anything about your skill set in this fight. I know you can knock out Matt Wyman in 22 seconds, but like, that's a guy who took 4.5 years off, came back, and hasn't won a fight since. So for Jordan Leavitt, he is one of those, I think he's in the UFC a little bit too early. And I do think we're going to be seeing more of this in the future with the cuts and whatnot. But, like, what do I know? He still went out there and got a 22-second knockout. So maybe there is a pretty exciting future for him. I think this is more like, yo, Matt Wyman, it's done. Like, you took all this time off. You've lost three in a row now. It's unfortunate, but I do feel like his game's just been passed up in MMA. He had a pretty good leg lock game back when he was fighting TJ Grant. Not friend of the show, but he does live pretty close by. it's never been the same for him after that, unfortunately. And we never saw a resurgence of Matt Wyman. Like, when GSP went away and then came back to fight Bisping, Simi won about him at middleweight, but he definitely looked like a guy who was getting better in all that time off. Like, he was in the gym the whole time. With Matt Wyman, from what we've seen, we haven't really seen anything. Like, he just sort of gotten beaten really soundly in all of his fights coming back. He's on one of those Tyron Woodley streaks where you're not just losing, but you're losing every round of every fight that you're in. And that's just really concerning for a guy like him at his advanced age, too.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. I'm just going to read you my notes. And they're all over the place. Yeah. Trust me. They're all over the map. The Monkey King is quite a nickname. If you want to get a smile, go to Jordan Levitt's Tapology page, because here's what you're going to see. You're going to see Jordan Levitt trying to armbar a guy while looking straight at the camera, taking a picture of him, which is an interesting... I mean, Tapology always has some crazy pictures there, but that was a good one. So the kid's got 6 finishes, 2 decisions. He's on a 3-fight finish streak. He's at a syndicate. He's got a baby on the way. He's looking to fight again in the spring. Here's my takeaway with Levitt. He's a little corny. He is. But, I mean, listen, he celebrated with a splits and a double dirty dancing thing. The celebrations were longer than the fight. He's interesting. He's not like anyone else in the UFC. There's no one else you can be like, that's Jordan Love is just like that guy in fighting or in personality. So from that perspective, I think he's a little bit like a male Roxanne Modafari. He's just a little bit off, and no one else is like
him. In terms I would say his eyelids are the opposite of Ryan Hall's. Like, Ryan Hall blinks a little too much. Jordan Levitt didn't blink in his whole post-fight interview. Like, that was the thing that really scared me.
I know, it was interesting. Wyman, let's talk about Wyman for a second. Came back into our lives, like you said, in 2019. Lost every fight he's had. Finished by Luis Pena. Went the distance with Selecki. And obviously, you know, Levitt cut the lights out. Let's talk about Wyman and Levitt with our theme, because that's sort of what we have here. We have a vet who's probably on the way out, a prospect who's on the way in. Do you think that this is how the UFC is going to start matching? I mean, they got to make these cuts. So is it too on the nose for me to say we're going to start seeing loser leaves town matches? Or do you think that the UFC is just going to say, all right, who's got the biggest number and is generating the least interest?
Okay, so you might not know this, but back in the day, Craig and I were big WWE fans, and your boy loved Jeff Hardy. And the last wrestling event I've ever watched was, I think it was on SmackDown on Friday. He had a steel cage match against CM Punk, and he was in the top of the cage, and all he had to do was get out. But what people didn't know is he failed a whole lot of drug tests behind the scenes, and of course he wasn't going to get out. But to put on a great performance, CM Punk wins, and that's it for Jeff Hardy. And did it break my heart? Yes, it did, because I remember that, and that was like 11 years ago, which is half my life. But I do think we are going to see a lot more of these, like Johnny Hendricks versus Paulo Costa matchups, where they're a little one-sided, and in the side that they favor, it's going to heavily favor the young and up-and-coming guy. And here's the other thing, too. I don't think the UFC is just going to get rid of good talent when they do these cuts. I'm pretty optimistic in that regard. I don't think they're only going to get rid of bad guys. And again, I think Luke Thomas was the one who tweeted this out, and it really got me thinking, because the UFC hates it when other organizations can claim that they either have the best talent in the world. Like, Bellator kind of has that with Douglas Lima, but not to the full effect, if you will. But they hate it when other people have their fighters. They just, it's something about the UFC. They don't want to give away their top talent. So I'm a little bit more optimistic than most. Like, I don't think they are going to get rid of, okay, if you've lost and you're outside the top 15 and you can't sell tickets, like, you're gone. I do think we are going to see, you know, maybe the Jose Quinones of the world get cut. But I don't think if, you know, let's say if Jack Hermanson loses his next fight and then, you know, has like a close split decision after that, I don't think guys like that are going to get cut. I really don't think the UFC is going to open the floodgates and let the ONE Championships of the world, let the Bellators of the world, let the PFLs of the world even take all their talent from them.
Well, I think here's where this whole thing gets interesting, is that what you have here is a situation where pre-pandemic, the UFC could play keep away. And they could say, here's a guy that's really not doing much for us, but we could do a whole hell of a lot more for another organization. So let's just keep him here. We'll use him to build our prospects. He'll keep some gates. And then that's kind of what we'll do with him. the pandemic took that out of the equation because now there's not the money, the extra money laying around to do that. But I think what the UFC is going to do is they're going to look at other organizations and say, no one could have left our organization and done better than Ryan Bader. And who cares? Like, did Ryan Bader leaving and winning two belts in Bellator really change Bellator that much? Because that's the best case scenario for a fighter, to leave our organization and then win two belts in another organization. And really, has Bellator been able to do anything with the fact that Ryan Bader won two belts? Not necessarily. I mean, is their company on different footing than it was before Ryan Bader got there? Is he some guy that all of a sudden just took Bellator and put it on his back and blasted off like the Mandalorian into the sky? No, not necessarily. So I think that if that's the best case scenario for a leaving fighter, the UFC is still faced with the fact that if they're not a star in the UFC, they're not going to be a star in Bellator. And all they really have to worry about is losing stars, not losing good fighters.
So really, I guess my question is, and great point, not really something I'd considered all that much, but do you think we will see more kind of trades between MMA organizations with this going on, like the transfer of contracts? I know after, like when Ben Askren and Demetrius Johnson, when they had their sort of trade between the UFC and ONE, I expected we'd start seeing that a lot more often in the future. Do you think this could cause some of those sort of strange transactions between organizations?
It could. I think that what the UFC is going to do is, if they do anything, is they're going to say, we have this guy. They're gonna trade name for game. Like, here's a guy that we've been trying to get. Nobody knows who he is, but he's in ONE Championship. He's one of the best fighters. So we're gonna offer to ONE, because the reality, Matt, is that what ONE Championship needs is names, and what the UFC needs is talented fighters. So there, that makes a lot of sense for the go both ways. If you send a guy like, I don't even say Pooh because his name isn't big enough. But if you said,
I had a big name trade in my head.
Go ahead, give it to me.
Would the UFC be willing to trade Max Holloway for AJ McKee?
I don't know if they would do it to Bellator, but I think that that's the exact thing that I'm talking about. You trade Max Holloway to Bellator, and next thing you know, it's him and Alimale McFarlane on a Hawaii card. Like, that's a big deal for Bellator. And what do you lose? You lose a guy that's probably never going to be a star anyway. Just not. Exactly. If he was a star, he'd be one by now. So, I don't think that being in other – I'm of the belief that being in other organizations doesn't necessarily stop you from being a star. Justin Gaethje was a star in the Royal Series of Fighting. Everybody knew who he was because of how he fought. We just didn't know if he was good enough to do that same shit in the UFC, and turns out he was. So, yeah, I could see a lot of the trades like that make a lot of sense for both parties. All right, let's move on to the prelim card. This is where Matt shines. He shines everywhere, but this is particularly where he shines way over me. All I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the fight, and let me know if you have anything to say about it. All right, Luis Smoka versus Jose Quinones. Smoka defeated him via TKO, 2:15 in the second round. What do you got?
Okay, so I predicted this fight very wrong. I'm really hung up on this new thing that I've been focusing on a lot where, again, you're a basketball guy, so I think you'll appreciate this. You know what the best way to defend your guy in basketball is? Don't let him get the ball in the first place. You know what the best way to defend a takedown is? Move your feet. If you keep on moving your feet and you have really good footwork, they're never going to be able to get a hold of you in the first place. I really thought the movement of Jose Quinones is going to give Luis Smoka a lot of problems. And it did early on in the fight. It just seemed like he was working at a pace that he couldn't keep up throughout the whole three rounds. You could tell that, yes, he was having success in that first round, but even those things were going his way, you could kind of tell, okay, Smoka is still landing though. Like, even though this is a Quinones fight, Smolka's not completely out of it. So then you have to ask yourself, okay, well, if this starts becoming a Smolka fight, how's Jose Quinones going to look? The second that fight hit the mat, Luis Smoka just completely big brothered him. Got in a mount, cut through his guard like it was nothing, gets full back control, ground and pounds him into the ground. Jose Quinones is in one of those weird situations where all of his wins are of guys who are no longer in the UFC, and all of his losses are against half-decent competition. So you never really knew where you could put Jose Quinones as a talent in really either division, be that bantamweight or flyweight. Losing Luis Smoka, I think, kind of ruins your UFC run. It sucks to say, and I know that's something that we're probably going to be talking about a lot in these post-fight shows in the upcoming weeks, is just, if you're Jose Quinones, it never really worked out your way, and what everyone remembers you for is being the last Sean O'Malley victim. So it is kind of unfortunate for Quinones, but I do see this being the end of the road. For Luis Smoka, I thought his ground and pound looked really good. I thought his stand-up, he's weird because he's so hittable, but he does seem to make good improvements every fight with Team Oyama, great team to be with. So I am excited for Luis Smolka. I do feel like he is still adding new parts to his game. He's still really young, even though this is the second round in the UFC. So I'm excited to see where they match up Smolka going forward. But the fact that he missed weight, if you will, or was deemed medically unfit to cut the weight in his last matchup, which was supposed to be against Quiñones, and they rebooked it for, of course, last night, just kind of weird. I don't know where you put him in the division. Can he safely make the weight, which is A, the most important thing of all, and who do you match him up with next? Because beating Jose Quiñones doesn't really tell me much about you.
All right, Ilia Topuria defeated Damon Jackson by knockout in the first round at 238. What do you got here?
Okay, if there's a Rookie of the Year award, Ilia Topuria is going to be getting it. He fought exactly like Aaron Pico, and I mean that in the best way possible. I don't mean like chitty Aaron Pico from the first round of his career. Ilia Topuria went out there, held his hands high, and put one of the worst beatdowns on Damon Jackson you'll ever see. He was throwing left hooks to the body like he was Danny Garcia, not a great name to drop after last night, but still, he was throwing beautiful left hooks to the body, and the finishing sequence that he was able to land on Damon Jackson, he goes left hook to the body, folds Jackson, overhand right over the shoulder, puts him down, and then like left uppercut while he's up against the cage. It was some Mortal Kombat level stuff, and really excited for Topuria in the future. I don't think he's the most heavy-handed guy at 145, but he does seem to be showing, I'm going to say Josh Emmett level, you know, power. Like, he needs one good shot and he can put down anyone in the division. And the craziest thing is the grappling is the best part of his game. So if he can keep on making these improvements in his striking, and hopefully he doesn't become Bangkok ready and just fall in love with his striking and forget about the grappling aspect of his game. But Ilia Topuria is really a name you got to watch out for moving forward.
And then finally, Jay Collar defeated John Volante by unanimous decision. 30-27s all across the board. What'd you have here?
I wish I was like you and didn't watch the prelims when fights like these are on. Because, okay, Jean Volante, I picked him. I'm not going to lie. Even though I tell myself every prediction video we do, I'm not picking Jean Volante this time. But I did. And Jay Collier, this is two guys who aren't fighting in their right weight classes. You kind of, like, Daniel Cormier is big. Or Derek Lewis is big, for instance. But he actually looks like a heavyweight. Like, he's just sort of big boned, if you will. Jay Collier, like, you've seen him at 185. You've seen him at 205. He takes a lot of time off, and now we see him at heavyweight. And just the dramatic change in which his body has underwent from 185 all the way up to 265. And I can say 265 because it's not like he's a guy who he weighs in at, like, that 230 range, like a Chris Daukaus or maybe even a Tom Aspinall. No, like, he weighs in at the top of the scale for heavyweight. So it's a good win. Jean Volante, he is the epitome. Like, he's the guy who created my scale of the earlier they mentioned your personality, probably the more disappointing you're going to be with their performance. But really unfortunate. Jean Volante, he was sort of a fun guy at 205 for a little while. He put on exciting fights. He had a couple good wins. Not to say he was ever going to be a title challenger or anything, but he was just sort of a fun guy to watch. And it's not really even the same athlete at this point. Good win for Jake Collier, though. It definitely keeps him in the UFC.
Yeah, Jean Volante is kind of like, you know, the Andy Samberg group, the Lonely Island. John Volante's like Weidman, you know, all the guys you know, and then John Volante's like, you know, the comic relief in that. All right, let's move on to the wrap. We'll start with some housekeeping notes. Fight of the night with Jack Hermanson and Marvin Vettori. Each guy got $50,000. Performance of the night, Gabriel Benitez and Justin Jaynes. $50,000 to Benitez. Performance of the night, Matt Wyman and Jordan Leavitt. $50,000 to Leavitt. Matt, you don't cut the checks, but if you did, is this how you'd have cut them?
I mean, probably. I can't disagree with any of those. We had one of the nicest slam knockouts I've ever seen. I think we both agree the main event was 100% the fight of the night. And that, for performance of the night, the only one who really has a say, I guess, would be Ilia Topuria. I do think the combination that he put together to put out Damon Jackson was not second to none, but it was some high-level stuff. And I was really impressed by his performance as a whole. But yeah, I do think they got it right on this one. Gabriel Benitez need a man across the cage. I'm not going to say that he does not deserve it. So yeah, I'm pretty happy with all those. I know it always seems like there's one fight on the event or one bonus that either wasn't handed to the right guy or just, you know, wasn't really, or I guess a performance that wasn't respected as much as it should have been, but I think they got it right with all these.
All right, let's move on to the victory lap. Listen, now's the time when you hit the long ball, you stare at it for a second, Matt, you take your time getting around the bases. Let's talk about the predictions you absolutely nailed.
Okay, so the Benitez one, I was pretty proud of myself. I called that fight to a T, predicted pretty much the way he was going to win as well. Now, the odds were pretty clear. Actually, he was a fairly decent favorite on that, so That's not that big of a deal. Called Ilya Topuria. The one that I got wrong, again, I got three wrong. I went 5-3 with my total predictions. Not the best weekend ever, but it is what it is. You're still above 500. Jake Collier, I did not call that one. I picked John Volante. That's on me. Again, if you tell yourself not to do something, you shouldn't do it. Never pick John Volante in an MMA fight. Moving up, Topuria. Craig and I both called that. We're big Topuria fans. We really like where he's going in the future. Jose Quiñones, he let me down. After that first round, I did predict him to win. I thought the movement was going to give Smoke a lot of issues. Turns out it wasn't. Turns out his ground game is non-existent. Jordan Leavitt got that one. I didn't think he was going to win in that violent of a way, but again, it was more of a pick against Matt Wyman than it was a pick for Jordan Leavitt. And that sucks to say, but Matt Wyman, he's on, you know, one of those like Carlos Condit-esque streaks right now. And that's the last thing you ever want to see from a fighter who you sort of, not that I grew up really watching Matt Wyman, but he's just a name that's been around for so long. And then, of course, in the main event, did not predict that one right, of course. I thought Jack Hermanson was going to get it done. I thought the output was going to be too much for him. I thought his cardio was really going to give Vettori problems. I didn't call Vettori pillow-fisted, but I definitely thought about it in the back of my head once or twice. And he proved all that wrong. Like, he went out there. I think the improvements that Marvin Vettori showed really can't be just underset, I guess. Because the striking from what it was when he was really, like, sort of those labored hooks, now that he's throwing, like, really crisp combinations and he is putting everything together, I think Marvin Vettori, he impressed me more than anyone on this card. And then, oh, I completely skipped over the co-main event. I did call Jamahal Hill. I know that was one that Craig and I were differing on quite a bit, but just the fact that Jamahal Hill fights very similar to a younger OSP, whereas he just kind of gets after it. He does a lot of the same things. He's that long southpaw stance. He can crack you with a straight left. He can hit you with a lot of nice kicks. It was just sort of, can OSP beat a younger version of himself? And I definitely think he's not even on the back nine of his career. Like, he's chipping on the 17th hole probably, so I'm just sort of concerned about where OSP is at this point. But no, didn't do that bad with my predictions all in all.
All right, let's move on to some takeaways from tonight. When you think back at this, you know, I'm much closer to having grandkids than you are. But when, you know, if for some reason you ever sit with your grandkids and decide you want to talk about, you know, UFC Fight Night 14, whatever this was, Vettori versus Hermanson, what's the main takeaways that you have from this card? What's going to stick with you?
I do think it's going to be two different things. I do think Ilya Topuria is a guy who you have to watch out for really just to see where he can go. Because if his grappling, not even if his grappling, his grappling is the best part of his game. And the fact that his striking is at such a high level at this point, I'm extremely impressed. And then also Marvin Vettori, like I don't want to say I counted him out of the main event, but I really didn't like his chances. I said Marvin Vettori can beat a lot of guys in the middleweight division. Just stylistically, Hermanson's a bad matchup. Because you have to ask yourself, okay, could Marvin Vettori knock out Jack Hermanson? Well, before that fight, I definitely didn't think so. Could he out-grapple him? Well, before that fight, I definitely didn't think so. But he was able to check all those boxes, put on a really impressive performance. So it would either have to go to one of those two. Who was your highlight of the night?
I mean, the Benitez stuff is going to stick with me just because I enjoyed it. But I'm with you. I think that, you know, Topuria, you guys are much deeper in the game than me with Topuria. But I do think that this is, if not the fight, that let us know that Vettori, it isn't the fight that let us know that he could be a champion. It's the fight that let us know he could fight for the belt. Like, I'm comfortable with him fighting five rounds against a championship level fighter. I don't know that he'd be in over his head in that kind of a fight. He represents himself. He may take one or two rounds from a legitimate champion from, like, you know, I mean, let's say Anderson was still the champion. He'd probably give Prime Anderson, he might give him two or three rounds. Prime Whitaker, he might go the distance or go four rounds. Israel Adesanya, I mean, we've already seen him go the distance with him. So now this Adesanya is different than that Adesanya. But it just lets me know that I feel better with him being on the other side of a poster right now for a championship-level main event.
It does kind of remind me.
Go ahead.
Just last point. It does really remind me of when Hermanson beat Jacare, because it was sort of a guy in the double digits of the rankings. He was down past 10. It was his first chance to really fight one of those top guys, and now sort of the position switch. So the fact that Vettori is, he finally got that big win. Now his name really is out there, and now we can start to match him up with those, you know, the Yoel, not the Yoel, goodness, I got to stop thinking that he's in the UFC, with the Costas of the world, with the, you know, Whitakers and Adesanya. Like, he couldn't be in a better position moving forward.
I like that he called out Costa. And I like, you know, he said a lot of things that you want to hear a guy in his position say. All right, who won the night? Whose night was it?
Whose night was it? It is hard to say who won the night. I don't think Dana White won the night. I can tell you that much. He seemed awfully upset afterwards. He had to say about all the cuts and whatnot. Again, it comes down to Marvin Vettori won the night. Like, he went from being just a guy at middleweight to, I'm not going to say he's the guy at middleweight, but he's finally in sort of the top three of every division. I've been going back and looking at like past rankings, and there's always sort of the big three in every single division. Like, the best example I can give you is, for the longest time at lightweight, you had Conor McGregor, Tony Ferguson, Khabib Nurmagomedov. Before that, there was Anthony Pettis, Frankie Edgar, Benson Henderson. Like, every division has those big threes. Right now at middleweight, you've got Robert Whittaker, you've got Israel Adesanya, because he's the champ, so it's hard to not consider him. And you've got Marvin Vettori right now. So he's in that, you know, top tier, if you will, of UFC middleweight.
I'm going to agree with you on the Vettori call, and I'll tell you this. You know, you're a Teddy Atlas guy. I'm a Teddy Atlas guy. Something that Teddy Atlas said is, you're not in a fight until you've had something to overcome.
Hello.
So when I look at...
I'm a Teddy Atlas guy.
So when I look at Vettori, when I look at Marvin Vettori, I don't look at... Okay, when I look at Israel Adesanya, I don't look at his all of his fights. The one that sticks out to me is Kelvin Gastelum. That was the night that he really became a champion. It was that night. Tonight was that kind of night for Marvin Vettori. He overcame something. Like I said, Teddy Atlas says you're not a champion until you have to, something to overcome. Vettori overcame something on this night. He can hang his hat on most significant strikes combined ever. This, to me, was like Robert Whittaker had the Yoel Romero fight. Adesanya had the Gastelum fight. Vettori has this fight. If he goes on to become a champion, I think that when you sit a fighter down and you say, I want to talk to you about 10 fights in your career, or let's shorten it. If you sit a fighter down and say, I want to talk to you about 5 fights in your career, Vettori picks this one as one of those 5. I think this was a big night for him. All right, let's talk about the notebook dump. This is just stuff that I kind of want to get off my chest. Things that are like not necessarily fight stuff, but just other stuff. I want to start with Chris Lee. Because Chris Lee gave – it was a split decision that he gave to John Allen. And this guy's got a history of being problematic. So I'm going to ask you this. The Allen fight from last night, Dos Anjos and Felder, Waterson and Angela Hill, Ryan Spann and Sam Alvey, which call by Chris Lee do you hate the most?
I do think it's that Paul Felder RDA one. I don't know how you can score that fight for RDA now, or for Paul Felder, sorry. Mine and Craig's grandmother watched Khabib Conor with us. She only watched the main card right up until the main event and then went to bed for some reason. She could have judged that fight better than poor Chris Lee, and she's only watched about 4 of them in her whole life. The fact that Chris Lee, I don't know if he's just never watched like wrestling before or has no idea what grappling is. And here's the wild thing too that I have to say. It's not like you can just set it aside like an Adelaide Bird where it's like, oh, well, Chris Lee's a boxing guy. He's not. Chris Lee has never judged a boxing fight in his whole entire life. So the fact that he's made it this far in MMA is really absurd to me. I do like how the booth held him accountable, though. Like, they kept on saying his name over and over and over again. And it's just weird. Like, I don't understand how the UFC can say, like, hey, Mario Yamasaki, you're not reffing our fights anymore. Like, you're so bad, we can just prevent you from being a part of our show. I know it's the commission that runs or figures out who the refs are, but we can make those sort of recommendations for the Yamasakis of the world. Why can't the UFC go, hey, Chris Lee, you're done? It doesn't make any sense into why he's still around. He has a history of doing this now. And after the RDA Paul Felder one, you're not going to find a bigger Paul Felder guy than you're seeing right here. I barely thought he won one round of that fight. So that's the one that really stands out to me. And I'm really surprised that there isn't sort of either long-term suspension or even like a rehabilitation program, for lack of a better term, for judges at this point.
And if there is, or there's something, then you need to be more transparent about it. So that's my takeaways. We need to be more aware of what it is. All right, I'll get you out of here on this. Let's talk about this booth. And then we'll talk about this. This will be a continuing conversation that we have. So we had Anik, we had Cruz, Felder, and Whitman. What do you think about that booth? What would be your dream booth?
Okay, so first thing, I actually really like the booth. Dominic Cruz is this weird thing where it really matters on who he's matched up with. Like, if he's with Rogan, I find just energy-wise, personality-wise, they don't mesh all that well. Because, you know, like, Rogan and DC like to be silly, and, like, they're kind of, you know, they're the more jovial of the people on the booth, whereas Dominic Cruz is very analytics-oriented. I like him and Paul Felder together because I feel like with Cruz, he's been a champ. He's forgot more MMA than I'll ever know. But he is sort of condescending, for lack of a better term, to the other booth members. Like, if he's breaking down underhooks or something, and if they pop in, like, he will kind of say, like, oh, well, I don't know about that. But with Paul Felder, there was a moment last night, I forget the exact fight, but Paul Felder was talking about checking leg kicks. And Dominic Cruz sort of disagreed with him at first, but he let Paul Felder actually, like, say his full point. And then Dominic Cruz was like, well, yeah, like, you're the last guy who I correct on checking leg kicks. So I do kind of like the dynamic that they do have. There does seem to be quite a bit of mutual respect between the two. And Trevor Whitman, one of his better nights, I thought. I really liked him in the main event. I thought he brought up a lot of great points about Rafael Cordero. I like the four that were there last night. Dream crew, though, without a doubt. John Anik, Dan Hardy, Michael Bisping, and then have Trevor Whitman on the side. I think those guys would be phenomenal. I think it'd be fun. You're going to get the information that you want, too. That would be my dream boot.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I'm not an Anik guy, but we've had enough of him. I mean, because I'm an old head, right? So although I know that Anik is much cleaner and more knowledgeable than Mike Goldberg is, this is what I've always said about Mike Goldberg. Mike Goldberg, the first 30 seconds of a fight and the last 30 seconds of a fight, better than anybody. Can get you into the fight and get you excited about it and can call a finish. Better than anybody, in my opinion. But, so, I mean, I don't know if I call him my dream booth necessarily, but I liked what they did last night. I really did. I think you're right on the money with that. At times, Dominic Cruz feels like he is the arbiter of common sense MMA wise in a booth, and he won't let Joe Rogan get away with some of the Joe Rogan stuff. DC's a little more forgiving of it. DC is smart enough to just sort of correct what Rogan says in his own analytics, in his own analysis, by saying, hey, this is what I'm seeing, without having to tell Rogan he's wrong. And I do think you're right that Cruz has a lot more respect for Felder than Rogan, for obvious reasons. But I thought it was a good crew last night. I think it's interesting with Whitman. He's so good at that gig that it's like he still wants to have a regular job, though. And it's like he shows you that position is a crucial position in the broadcast, but I don't know that I want it opened up to a bunch of other guys, because I don't want Whitman losing that gig, right? So if he can only be available for the big, maybe you only put him on pay-per-views, maybe you only do it on pay-per-views. I love him in that spot. What about the desk? Karen Bryant, Rashad Evans, and Kamaru Usman.
Nothing against them. It's always weird with the desk too, because again, that comes down to team chemistry a lot, it feels like. I like Usman. I do think he's made a lot of improvements since he first started doing it. Same thing could be said for Rashad. I feel like when they first sort of brought Rashad on, it was a little, there was definitely a feeling out process, but he has sort of morphed into that role right now. I love Angela Hill on the desk. I really do. I might be in the minority on that, but I really like it when it's Angela Hill, Karen Bryant, and Michael Chiesa. Those are my three favorite. I do like sort of, I think you need a good synergy of, like, here's the hard-hitting facts and, like, let's have some fun talking about it. I like sort of the Angela Hill, Karen Bryan dynamic. I like Michael Chiesa, who he'll kind of entertain that stuff, but he will, like, okay, guys, like, this guy's going to go for this single leg and sort of break it down in a little bit more detail. So I really like those three together, but I never have complaints about the desk. I never feel like there's that much of a shift in my viewing experience, no matter who's on it.
Yeah, for me, I think that it's one of those things where it's like you can't be too friendly with the people on a desk. If you're too buddy-buddy, you kind of get away from it. I think that there are certain people – I think Bisping does a great job on the desk. And I think that he has that where he's enough adversarial with the other people that come on the desk that it keeps it interesting. You never know what he's going to say. His analysis is good. Sometimes I struggle with not his accent, but like when he gets going, it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit too much, but I like him on the desk. I think he handles it well. So like him, Anik, and Felder are great for me. But you're right. Yeah. I don't think the desk really affects your viewing at all. All right. Let's talk about the next card in this, just in context of when's the next Fight Night picks. Give the rundown of what's coming up on the preview shows and all that.
So we're going to be filming them today and tomorrow, hopefully be released either late Monday night, early Tuesday morning. And yeah, it's for the big pay-per-view coming up. Deiveson Figueiredo making a quick turnaround against Brandon Moreno at old UFC 256. So yeah, make sure you keep it locked on Fight Night Picks. Question mark kicks Saturday right before the card too. We just started an hour before. I know last weekend we started 2 hours before. So I'm sure Craig and I will figure it out this week. But yeah, a lot of MMA content coming this week.
All right, guys, there you have it. Fight Night Picks recap show is in the books, the first of many. If you have anything you'd like to see on the show or any issues with it, I'm certain you'll let us know in the comments. Oh, yeah. I like it when you take shots at me in the comments. I find it adorable. So go ahead and give me your best shot. So for Matt Allen, this is John Franklin. We'll see you next time. Peace.